Hello, and welcome to Season 3, Episode 13 of Professors in Rooms Getting Coffee with Drs. Justin Winzenberg and Stephen Jones. In this podcast, we look to explore truth, beauty, wisdom, and goodness at the intersection of faith and scholarship. Today, we conclude our conversation with Marcus Dipsilas, who joined me in studio in Berlin to share his experience of searching for truth and finding hope. But first, here are our highlights, lowlights, and insights for the week. What are you drinking for coffee today?
Same old, some store-bought stuff. So mostly whatever's pragmatic. I think I mentioned to you, I played basketball early this morning at 6 o'clock. So I'm feeling tired a little bit now at the moment. So it's nice just to have something.
Did you say 6 o'clock in the morning for basketball?
Yeah, that's usually when we play.
Man, that's early.
It's a men's league. Since it's 4th of July week, we don't play games. We usually have games once a week. Well, I should say this, the teams play once a week, but there's games every day.
Okay.
It's just that your team might not play because there's a bunch of teams in the league. So this was pickup, but
when do you have to get up?
Usually around 5:15.
Man.
Early.
That's not a time I choose to be awake generally, but.
No, I don't usually choose to get awake then either, but I just get such little exercise these days and I like playing sports. So, and this kind of actually maybe this leads into my highlight for the week. So should I just give my highlight?
Sure. Yeah. Let's go for it.
I mean, well, that we didn't ask you though about your coffee. What are you drinking?
So at the
what
moment,
did you drink?
Yeah. At the moment I'm just drinking the one from the machine here in the office, but I have this week started doing cold brew. I got one of those cold brew pitchers and it's good.
Nice.
Yeah. I don't know. I've been enjoying it. Although then the last 2 days have been pretty chilly actually. Like I had a jacket on earlier today.
Wow.
Which was a nice change. We had quite a bit of heat not too long ago. And anyway, I'm kind of looking forward to the next warm day so I can enjoy my cold brew again.
See, I'll drink cold brew year round. It doesn't matter. I'll drink hot coffee year round as well. Yep.
So you were talking about a highlight here?
Yeah, well, we were talking about getting up playing basketball. One of my highlights has been I've been in this basketball league now for I think I just did the math today. 15 years I've been in this league for.
Wow.
And then I'm also in a softball league right now as well. It's been fun. It's summertime. It's nice to get out. I don't play basketball outside. I play inside in a gym at a church, but it's been fun being involved with these sports, kind of having some team camaraderie, but also a chance just to get out and move around a bit. So
yeah,
had a lot of fun over the last couple of weeks playing softball and basketball.
Nice. I wouldn't mind being on a softball league. I did that for a little while when I was teaching at the college and I enjoyed it, but I don't know. I'll have to look around. I have not heard of softball here. And there's hardly any baseball. Yeah. So I suspect there's not a lot of softball going on, but I enjoyed it when I did it.
Yeah. I played in a competitive league. Like it was probably D level, which is, it's still a rec league, but it was pretty competitive. We'd play tournaments on the weekends. So I used to do that before I had kids and it got just to be a little too much. We had some guys on the team that were pretty intense about it, where they, if you made an error, they'd yell at you. I'm like, I'm a grown man here. Like, I don't need to be told that I made an error. I know I made an error.
I'm aware.
I wasn't trying to do it. That's this funny. Team is much, much better. We have a lot of fun, but guys still want to win. So they try. So it's a men's league. But we have a good time.
Nice.
Yeah. What about you? What's the highlight for you?
I think highlight for me, I have a few different ones this week, but, we had our closing event and artist talk for the exhibit that we were doing in the gallery.
Oh, nice.
And that was just a really pleasant event. Yeah. I think there were a few different things that came together to make that a highlight for me. One was, it seemed like the artist really enjoyed the time, which was really good. It was something we were hoping for. And then also just there were some technical pieces that we'd worked on to try to make the event successful and they worked. So that was good. And then I ended up being able to speak in German for quite a while, had a long conversation actually with somebody who lives in the building here and really enjoyed that. But it was also encouraging just to actually be able to be using the German that I've worked on. But then a second highlight is that last night I started taking a Spanish class.
Oh, cool.
And so, and I think one
more
of the things,
languages.
Yeah. Well, and I had studied Spanish. Before coming here, Spanish was definitely my strongest language. And, I had felt like it was kind of getting lost behind the German. And, when I would go to speak Spanish, only German would come out, which was like super frustrating because I had been speaking Spanish since, 25 years or something like that. And so it was fun. But part of what was fun about it as well was that the people who were in the class were more local than the people who are in the German class, which of course, right? Like that makes sense.
Yeah. But,
So that was just, it was fun. It was a different group of people. And it was also fun because the reference language, like if we were having trouble with something, was sometimes English and sometimes German. And so it was fun to kind of see those three languages playing together in that space. So,
nice.
Yeah. A couple of highlights there.
That's great.
What's a low light for you?
For me?
Yeah.
Well, it's been interesting seeing some responses, I think, on Twitter over the past couple of weeks here, you know, with things happening politically in the States with Roe v. Wade. And then actually it's interesting now also seeing that as of recording right now, I think Boris Johnson just resigned.
Oh, did he? Okay. I heard there were a bunch of resignations in his cabinet.
Sounded like he's resigning or about to. Okay. So it's interesting following some of the chatter, I guess you could say, on Twitter, especially when it comes to politics. Mm-hmm. As a low light, it's been a low light because it's so polarizing.
Yeah.
And I don't really have an idyllic view that like there was any point maybe in US history where people just always got along. They disagreed, but they, you know, would go have a beer or something together. I'm not sure that ever happened. Maybe it did.
It was at least the story that we told, right? Yeah. No. Yeah. Like I remember, I definitely remember having the impression that, senators in Washington from, you know, the different sides would get together. Yeah. Outside of work and
sure
be friends. So
it's interesting just cause I've got friends on all, both ends of the spectrum on the Roe v. Wade conversation. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting kind of hearing it's what's been a low light for me is just seeing the same kind of game be played. I think a demonization of the other, an inability to hear, being quick to, demonize. And it's frustrating a bit. I mean, I don't know because it's such a heated issue and because it's so important to people, I'm not sure that it's easy just to say, all right, let's keep this civil. You know, I don't want to undermine people's feelings in thinking that they're invalid or anything either, because there's a lot behind these decisions, but it has been a bit lamentable to me, I guess, just seeing some of the reaction. And it is interesting. I saw post today about something where the person made a claim that like, this wasn't directly related to Roe v. Wade, but I think it could apply to a lot of the political situations. This person was saying, if you're in good standing with your family members, I seriously question whether you're standing up for like true justice.
Interesting.
Because which is very interesting. And this person, I think, wasn't coming from, it didn't appear that they were coming from like a conservative Christian vantage point, which was so fascinating to me because I've heard so many people in like sort of evangelical circles make the same claim.
Yeah.
Basically, like if you're not offending people, you're probably not sharing the gospel.
Interesting.
Right? That I've heard that. And this is kind of the same sentiment, mm-hmm. but being applied to a completely different situation from a completely different side of both political and religious spectrum. I thought it was just fascinating and thinking, yep, seems to me like everyone's kind of just playing the same games. Now I know some of our listeners might be frustrated thinking, no, we're not the same. I'm not saying that people are the same and that they think the same, but they're kind of the things I'm seeing that are frustrating me are when the same kinds of maneuvers are being made in the public conversations, I guess. Mm. I don't know what the way forward is. I don't know. I suspect I'm not a prophet or anything, but I suspect that it's not going to get better. That all of a sudden these polarization is going to just kind of settle down. So I don't know. It's been frustrating to watch.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense.
Well, how about for you?
So for a low light for me?
Yeah.
I think so. The low light for me, so certainly what you're talking about has been on my mind, and maybe there's an insight in there, we'll see. But I think the more immediate low light for me is that last week, one of my teammates headed back to the US for a few months of home assignment. And then tomorrow, the rest of his family goes and is on home assignment. And I think it's probably good that they're doing what they're doing. They're required to, but I think it's probably a good exercise to go and reconnect with people there in the States. But so there's a couple levels of it. So part of it is just, I like being with those people. And so I miss them. But there's also this feeling of, I should let that breathe. I miss them, and that makes me sad. Okay, so there's that. And then there's also the reality that with them being gone, the combination of them being gone and then my three colleagues here that are also staff are all in language school full time right now. I'm the only one that's not. And so it's led to a few mornings this week where I've been the only one at the office, and it's a little bit lonely. It's kind of demotivating for me, because I realized this was the first week that I have had a moment where I'm like, I really don't want to go into work. And even just the framing of that, I don't even usually think about it of like, okay, I'm going to work, or I'm coming home from work. It's more like, oh, I'm going to the office, I'm going to go do some stuff with some people. And just the feeling of like, oh, I miss that.
Yeah.
So I think it'll get better, get new patterns established and whatnot. And then they'll come back and I'll be like, hey, what are you doing here? it'll be good. But I think, that's been a low light for me, is just, even though it's an expected change, it's still, it's stuff to get used to.
Yeah. So, do you have an insight then in there too?
I think, so here's an insight. Maybe I keep being surprised at the way in which God seems to work things together. So just today I was over next door. I think when you were here, I showed you the space that we thought we might get to expand Envision Berlin into. And we just today got the keys for it.
Wow. Yeah.
And cool. The timing was just like, the person who needed to sign is my colleague who's flying out tomorrow. And so, the timing was perfect. And it's amazing. And somebody gave money unexpectedly that will cover our deposit and will help us get some of the initial furnishing done for it. And so, there's plenty of work, of course, that comes with that. And there's plenty of things that we'll have to do. But I think sometimes, so this connects to your low light in a weird way, in that sometimes it's easy for me to look at all of this junk that's happening. And I have to say, like, looking at American news and American commentary recently has been really, really disheartening to me. And kind of a little anxiety invoking. But I think at the same time, like, the reality is, like, my lived reality is that things keep moving forward in good ways. And so I think part of the insight is, it's not that there aren't things to worry about. There definitely are, but I think to also live into the reality that is not the only story of what's happening. So I would say that it's an insight that I'm kind of like a little bit like, okay, I guess there's another story, and I need to remember that other story and live into it, rather than being like, oh, I have this profound insight. It's like, just good to be reminded of.
It's a good reminder, man, especially with all the stuff that is going on over on the other side of the pond over here.
Yeah. How about for you? What's an insight?
You know what? I should probably just state from the outset, I do understand in talking about some of the political stuff that's happening, especially related to Roe v. Wade, that like, I think it's going to impact me very differently as a male, as a white male, than it would a lot of other people. So I don't want to be dismissive of saying, oh, come on, this is just a political issue. I'm not saying that. But I did have this interesting realization as I saw friends on both sides of the spectrum lashing out at the other side. And my thought was this, and maybe it's because of doing PhD work. I feel like PhD work taught me at least the sense of, and I think I've mentioned this before, that you kind of have to learn to be a little more cautious of demonizing and of lashing out against opponents or people that you disagree with, especially like when in publication. So I think you have to show some respect. You have to show, you can certainly disagree. I mean, that's encouraged, but so there's something in me, I think, that what my immediate thought was, as I heard some lashing out, especially seeing some of our friends who have kids, I thought, man, how many people do I know that think the same politically as their parents?
Mm.
Not many people. I mean, there's certainly, like, they might be in similar camps, but, sure. But on issues, it's quite diverse, you know? And the reason I thought of this is I thought, how many folks, when demonizing the other side, could potentially be demonizing their own future children? Mm. You know, people who will disagree with them on politics, people who will not accept the presuppositions that they've been fed by their parents, no matter what side you're on, and to what extent that as a parent who absolutely loves, I mean, you can't, this is like unthinkable when your kids are 5 and 2 and you're just, oh, they're so cute and you love them to death. And then someday they grow up to be grown adults who don't think like you, don't act the way you want them to, because they're the way that every generation is, right? Like, right. I mean, that's not true that some people don't think similar to their parents politically, but I don't know a lot of people that I would say align very well with their parents on politics. So it just makes it a sobering thought to say, when we're demonizing the other, when it comes to these views, could we be potentially people my age, could we be demonizing our future children? And how, if we can't handle the other person and their viewpoint now, how are we going to handle our own children when they disagree with us?
Do you think, I think that what I struggle with, because I definitely agree with you, what you're saying, like one of the things that I try to work toward is humanization, right? Like, and interacting with the complex person, the complex other. I wonder though, too, like, I think sometimes there is absolutely ground for, I don't know, like, for anger and for rejection of tactics and of ways of being that are in and of themselves dehumanizing. You know what I mean? Like, like there's one thing to talk about. There are, in my mind, very legitimate disagreements in terms of stance and even in terms of the way that you would argue about one side or another for Roe v. Wade. And then there are, and maybe in some ways this is what you're talking about, there are ways of enacting those perspectives that are sometimes just wrong. And so whether that's in terms of, you know, legal process or whether that's in terms of rhetorical decisions or, you know.
Yeah. Like, and I want to be cautious because I mean, are there issues that are just such so loaded and so important ethically that you have to draw a line in the sand, you have to offend, you have to even call out quite blatantly, and you have to even do so with vigorous fury, perhaps, right? Yeah. I mean, I think the danger always in taking the sort of exhibiting the frustration that I'm saying at the moment is that it makes it seem like, no, it's not worth the fight. You know, no, like these things aren't that big a deal. Come on, stop making it a big deal. I'm not saying that at all. Like there are issues ethically that are so important that require some of that. But there's a posture though too. And it just makes me wonder if we can't like look at the other person in the eye and humanize them when they deeply disagree with us. What will we do when our children inevitably disagree with some of our passionate political views? Yeah. Because that's a lot easier. That's a harder question when it hits home like that than it is when it's that relative you don't get along with, that person on Twitter that you don't know, that person whose posts you've been reading, that person who you once knew, but you never really liked them much to begin with. Okay. Now it hits closer to home. Now it's your kid. It's your two-year-old who grew up to be 23 and not think anything like you wanted them to. And it's so interesting because I think both sides of the political spectrum would probably admit that one of their greatest fears is that their kids grow up to be the other. Mm-hmm. Like, honestly, I don't quite think that way because I'm politically, I'm a mutt, I would say. I feel like I'm a mutt, but and I've talked about that before on the podcast, right. But it just, it makes me wonder just a little bit. I don't know if I have answers for it. So I don't know what the insight is, except just, it's an observation to think about the humanization of right. others who deeply disagree with us and thinking like, okay, what would it be like if it were our kids? And I know not our, all our listeners have children, and that's not, I'm not suggesting that there are people who don't have kids can't figure that out, but it was a sobering thought for me as a parent to think through that and to go, what are the chances that my kids are going to grow up to be exactly what I would hope they become with particular viewpoints?
We'll be back in a moment to conclude our conversation with Marcus Dipsilas. Find bonus content and more at patreon.com/profsandrooms.
I'm a big proponent of people finding out that I am a follower of Jesus without me actually saying the words, I am a follower of Jesus. Because the presupposition is truth has to be spoken. That the gospel must be preached, and preached equals only speaking, only using words. And none of this is new, right? People have been doing this discussion, or this discussion has been had years before our time. But incarnational truth or incarnational living to me is probably the most truthful way for me to exist in myself, to be true to myself, and exist in a world to be true to God and to be true to my fellow men. When Lauren and I were living in Malaysia, we had a friend who was a new friend that we made as a married couple. She was very interested, both her and her partner were very interested in why we chose to come back to Malaysia, who we were, our story. And we shared unreservedly, with the exception of ending with a, now do you want to follow Jesus? Now Jesus came to save your life. And we didn't do any of that intentionally, at times against our own knee-jerk reactions to do it. Like, we had to fight the impulse that we had grown up in to immediately share something and try to get a profession of faith from this person for them to profess what was true, big T, Jesus is true. And we were friends with them for 2 years. And the week before we left, we gave her a Bible, and we wrote on the Bible, this has changed our lives, and we hope that in the way you read it, it will change yours. And in not so many words, she basically told us that she was prepared to know Jesus, but she was afraid that she would have to abandon who she was culturally, because that's what had been told to her before. She had to be a Christian by forsaking her people.
Which means something in that context, which, right? Like, that's a political identity.
It's social identity.
Yeah, it's bigger than just when Americans think about what does it mean to become a Christian. It's a smaller part of our lives in some ways than what you're describing.
Right. And so, you know, she asked some questions, which I thought was like, wow, okay, so you've been thinking about this for a while. You know, can I follow Jesus and still honor my parents, honor my ancestors? Can I, you know, put the joss sticks? Can I go clean the grave during this auspicious day? Can I, you know, put food in front of this name plaque of my ancestors and stuff like that? And for me, I had to resist the urge to say, no, you cannot do these things, because it is trained into me to say that, no, following Jesus means following Jesus alone. But if she had come to this point without us redirecting her on the road, like, what right did I have now to then come in after the Holy Spirit has done all this work all these 2 years in our friendship, where she sees how we live? I mean, she was seeing in close proximity when we hosted the Syrian refugee, and we were honest with our emotions and what was going on. Like, she knew it wasn't just this thing like, oh, Marcus and Lauren are here to help people and they're all just do-gooders. She knew there was something deeper, that we didn't want to do it, or we were hesitant, but we still did it. Something motivated us deeper, and it had meaning. There was beauty to it, right? And so she was drawn to that without the caricatures of truth just being a statement that I say with my mouth. And so we don't have, we haven't gotten a faith statement out of her. We've not talked about this, but we know what we trust that she's on a journey herself, that Holy Spirit is doing something in her heart. And I don't want to presume and take that position and force something out prematurely. If she's going to come to him, then he will set the terms for that. And so for me, that is how, you know, truth as it relates to evangelism has been for me. I don't, you know, and there are times that I've told people directly, like, follow Jesus, he's good for you. I've said that. But there are times that I feel like, no, I don't have to say that right now. It doesn't mean it's less true, but I just, those words can be changed, right? I don't have to say the exact same way every single time I'm sharing with someone about who God is.
What do you think your approach in that situation or the situations you've just been sharing about, do you think can be attributed to your comfortability with ambiguity? Mm.
There's something beautiful in ambiguity because I am not responsible to have all the wires meet. I don't have to have all the wires plugged into the right slots for truth to be true. Like there is room for myth and mysticism and mystery. And somehow all three of those meet and they might sound contradictory, but they meet and there's something beautiful there. There's space, I think, for God to work beyond what I've put him in the box that I think he's going to do. There's space for discovery of who I am and who Christ is to me. And not just in a very personal way, in a very quote unquote evangelical, Jesus is my personal savior way, but also in what it means for my people. Yeah.
As I'm hearing you process that, one of the things that I'm thinking about is how some of the ways that we interact with truth, maybe ambiguously, or, you know, in some of these indirect approaches to truth, that the arts, that creative expression become really important. I mentioned narrative earlier as being an important element of that. You are a creative, you're a musician, you're a photographer, you're a videographer. You're also a baker, is that right? You make cheesecakes?
I make food, yeah. Yeah.
And you enjoy cooking. And we enjoy your cooking. And, but yeah, I'm just curious, how do you think about the intersection between creative expression and truth and beauty?
Yeah. So the Asian perspective on creatives is that if I were to go back, well, specifically Chinese, I guess Chinese and Japanese, kind of what the West would call the Oriental perspective on beauty, truth, and wisdom. Philosophers were not just people who stood in public squares, rarely actually people who stood in public squares and debated topics. They were poets. So a lot of wisdom in Chinese culture was communicated through poetry. And it was wisdom in that it was quote unquote true or truth. And it was beautiful to read and beautiful to repeat, to behold. You know, a lot of these people were also at the same time advisors to kings. I mean, they wrote books, they wrote poetry, they wrote prose, they wrote, they drew paintings and pictures and created new forms of art. And then they also advised rulers on the strategy of war. So it's really interesting to me that there were no clear lines of here's a creative and their job is just to inspire beauty. It was that beauty has truth, beauty has wisdom, and the inverse is true. Truth has beauty and wisdom has beauty and truth. So it's kind of like how the three out of your four themes, I guess.
So in some ways, the beauty of the poems contributed to the truthfulness of the poems, and the truthfulness of the poems contributed to the beauty of the poems. Is that right?
That's a fascinating thought. I think the beauty of the poems made truth something people wanted to hear. Mm. The beauty of idioms. Idioms and metaphors are meant to communicate certain kind of truth, I guess. And oftentimes the truth comes from an anecdote or a experience that someone has, and then they put it into an idiom. And there's imagery to it, especially in Chinese and Malay idioms and proverbs. There's imagery. It's not static. You know, sometimes it causes you to think creatively, you know, to picture things in your mind. And it also communicates truth. So maybe it makes it more palatable.
In a way, what it reminds me of, Justin, is your assignment, your Spotify assignment.
Yeah. You want me to share about that?
Yeah, yeah.
You never took Gospel of John with me, did you, Marcus?
No, only Romans. And I'm really sad, but the only interaction I had with you in class was online.
It was online. I remember that. Yeah. Yeah, it's a bummer. But it happens. I remember when I was in seminary, there is a prof there who I adore. I mean, she's fantastic. She's a top-notch scholar, and I somehow got through without taking a class with her, and I deeply regret it. So I'm not saying you feel that way about me, but
I do.
It happens.
I do.
And I wish too. Well. You took the contextualization class before it was really a class. You did it as an independent study. So the one that we did together.
That's right. Yeah. So that's an interesting assignment. What I have students do is I have them pick music that they like, and then I have them do the sort of imaginative exercise of finding scenes in the Gospel of John that they think that the music could connect with, sort of the underlying narrative. So I let them be very creative. I mean, we get all sorts of really interesting things: Jesus clearing the temple, being paired with Miley Cyrus's Wrecking Ball.
Funny.
And again, it's, you know, some people might say like, oh, that's a silly assignment, but it kind of activates this part of students' brains. And in my brain, I cannot read that story now of Jesus in the temple without thinking of Miley Cyrus as Wrecking Ball.
Is that helpful or sacrilegious? A little bit of both at the same time.
Now that's it. Now, right? Yeah. I'll leave that up to you. Now, I'm not talking about the video, okay? Mm-hmm. I'm not saying the video, just the song. There's that song. I can't remember who it's by, a country song. It's called Boondocks. Mm-hmm. And so a couple of students had attached that song with the statement coming in the early part of John's gospel: can anything good come from Nazareth?
Oh, interesting.
Right? So like the sense of like Jesus came from the boondocks. So it's like stuff like that where, you know, some people could say, oh, that's ridiculous. It's silly. And I try to remind students, look, these songs weren't written with a Gospel of John in view, but what I like about it is it gets students to start thinking about what these scenes are doing, what they mean, but by borrowing from this completely other way of seeing the world and thinking, which is music. And so I've loved that project. There's always multiple papers every semester that I've ever done it that just I either laugh or I cry, you know, because there's just some powerful ones that that come out. So that's kind of a creative assignment.
Part of what's interesting to me about that is, on the one hand, you could say, you could critique your assignment, when one could critique your assignment and say, well, but that's not true, right? Like Jesus didn't come into the temple like a wrecking ball. And this is definitely playing in my head.
Not a wrecking ball. Now, of course, there's some deep problems with that, depending on what you mean by wrecking ball. Mm-hmm. And I try to remind students, look, I'm sorry, I shouldn't talk with ice in my mouth. Okay. There's some deep problems, right, with thinking of Jesus as a wrecking ball there. And that could lead to some bad misinterpretations of the passage. But I also try to remind students, like, when you're using songs, like, you don't connect every lyric to the scene. Like, right. The whole first part of that song, it's not going to work, right? And so I just get them to try to almost, I kind of say, hey, you're creating a Gospel of John movie, or you're creating a Gospel of John play, and you're in charge of the soundtrack for it.
Right.
So what would you have, what would you play in these instances? And sometimes it's, you know, instrumental. Sometimes it's Miley Cyrus, and sometimes other artists. But I love the project because it gets them to think about the scenes differently. And I do try to draw limitations on it, saying, look, don't try to get too wild with this and thinking that the song is expressing everything from the scene. But
it sounds,
it
like,
also kind of can reveal sometimes when they misinterpret something.
Right. Yeah, that's what I was thinking. Is it in some ways, while somebody could critique your assignment and say, but this isn't true, there is an interaction with truth that goes deeper because of that assignment, right? As well as then giving the opportunity to identify things that aren't true to say, you know, well, hold on, you know, this isn't quite what's happening in this portion of John or, you know, whatever. I think, that's really interesting.
But in there's all these, I mean, interpretively, there's so many limitations to it, but you get these denials of Peter in the Gospel of John, and students kind of are just so used to hearing it. Yeah, they know it if they've been around church circles, but I try to get them at least to imagine, and it's a very imperfect exercise. We don't know what Peter felt. We don't know what was in his brain at the time. We can't do that historically, go back in time and read his mind, but it's interesting to hear them when they pick a song they think could be an expression of what Peter might have felt. Something like that. And again, it's so imperfect, but I like the exercise, and then it gets them to go beyond just, Peter denied Jesus, whatever else, move on to the next scene, and gets them to sort of immerse themselves into the perspective of what it might have been like for these characters to go through this narrative and to experience the things they experience. And it's limited, right? We're doing it from a 21st century cultural vantage point, and even our own 21st century cultural vantage point, which has significant limitations to a first century one and a Western to Eastern, you get all of those limitations. But I still think it's a worthwhile exercise.
To Peter denying Jesus, I would pick Billie Jean by Michael Jackson.
Yeah, there we go.
I was thinking when Jesus sees Peter, you know, after the resurrection, I was thinking of Hello.
Oh, from Adele?
From Adele.
Hello. Yeah. Adele?
Yeah. It's me.
It's me.
No. Hello from the other side.
Okay. Oh, hello. Yeah.
Hello from the other side. I wanted to go over everything.
Well, that's theological too, because he came back from the other.
But see, that's kind of humorous too, right? It's humorous, but it's kind of a memorable thing to think about, like, oh, if that were like Jesus singing that to Peter kind of thing, right? Mm-hmm. It'd be, it's again, kind of ridiculous, but is it any more ridiculous than God's Spell or Joseph and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat? Like, no. And in a lot of ways, what it does is it engages this other aspect, this other way of like immersing ourselves in the gospel scenes and speculating for a little bit. That's a creative thing. I think too much of a biblical interpretation is non-imaginative, and we really despise speculation sometimes. And it's like, no, we have to speculate, and so long as we admit it's speculation, then let's just do it. And let's let our imagination unwobble a bit. Yeah, we check it to the best we can, and then we admit what we know, what we don't know. And so I actually use it as a stepping stone oftentimes to then go and say, well, what do we know about this scene? Or what, in what ways might these perspectives that we're bringing into the scene actually misrepresent what's maybe being said?
You know, so I was at a Georgia O'Keeffe exhibit the first week I was in Switzerland, which was about, it's only been a week and a half ago. I've only been here a week and a half. It's felt like I've been here a long time. But I was at a Georgia O'Keeffe exhibit in Switzerland. And she is she's known as a modernist painter. Some people would say that she, you know, kind of made, so her series of painting flowers looks very sexual or it's very sensual. And that's perhaps what she's known for. But when I was at this exhibit, I went in kind of, they were introducing who she was and how she got to where her art went, and also what influenced her. There was a quote by her. I'm going to paraphrase. I won't get it factually accurate, but I'll try contextually. But the she was responding to someone's question, I believe, or the concept of realism in paintings. And she, to the effect of not dismissing realism, but kind of critiquing realism, said that if you want to get to the truth of something, you can't use realism in art. You have to take a portion of it, turn it over, emphasize it, distort it a little bit. Like, you have to really get down and dirty, basically, with it, because realism doesn't give you, it gives you a larger picture, but it doesn't bring you in. You don't get intimate with the object. That's how I understood that quote that she said. It just really just like, it gave me this perspective into her world. Why did she paint flowers so close up? And people are like, oh, it's, you know, she's part of the feminist movement and she's trying to, you know, but I think it was deeper than that. Like she was really for her own learning, trying to find what is a flower? What does it mean for the flower to be beautiful and to emphasize certain parts and not other parts? Like what did it mean for her on that journey? And I think that that to me is what art and beauty does on this journey of learning truth, right? Like for me as a, you know, I've not written many songs. The songs that I've written are very personal. They're more often than not for myself, for processing. I don't really release it to the world. I have a couple for, let's say, New Song Chapel at Crown. I would write new songs for that in which students perform. It was new song and then turned into new art. They would perform different things that they had created. But most of the things that I write are for me. Most of the art that I produce is for myself. That's a privilege I know many artists don't have, who artists who need to feed themselves have to turn to commercialization to paint what is trendy or what people want to see to get money to feed themselves. I think I'm lucky in that to have the privilege to create only when I want to create, which leads to very authentic creations that might not really be pretty by other people's standards. But so with music, with writings, with stuff like it, a lot of it is for me, but to then realize like as someone who creates art or food, that, you know, I can follow a recipe and be true to a recipe, and this can be a dish that is not appropriated. I think that's also a big discussion. Like, what is appropriation and how do you not take someone's history and then just turn it into something that's palatable for yourself because you have just dismissed their entire process of how they got there. But when I create something to be like the essence of this dish or the essence of this piece of music, it's not found in how realistic it is, because then we think that what is real is true, or you know, what is realistic is truthful. But it's found in me like getting to know it. And that again, I think connects to truth is relational for me, is when I cook something, it's not whether I followed the recipe that makes me realize that I've done a good job. It's that I today got to emphasize a different part of the dish and I got to know it a little more, right? That as a creative drives me to then think about, oh, the next time when I cook it, it's going to be a little bit different than this time because here are the rules of the recipe. I know the ingredients. Now I get to do something according to my palate, and that would change. It's not static. Yeah.
I like that idea of realism versus, I don't know, surrealism or whatever you would like it to be in art. I remember seeing this some, another exercise we did in my Gospel of John class was to look at art depictions of the raising of Lazarus. And we pulled from it, you give out like a Rembrandt, and Rembrandt was very more realistic. And what was interesting is Rembrandt's kind of realism often caused students to want to ask historical questions of it. Wait a second, would the tomb have looked like that? Would Lazarus have been buried like that? Would these people have worn those clothes? And they're asking all these historical questions. And then you get
and the truth is no. The answer to that question is
right. No, you're right.
No, few shades too fair.
Which I think the problem is we're treating that, you know, for one, I mean, we're probably treating it in a way we shouldn't be treating the artwork, but then we had a Van Gogh, and Van Gogh's Lazarus scene is so interesting because it was the only painting we looked at that was very bright. The sun was just piercing down. It had no depiction of Jesus. It had the two women, which you assume are maybe Mary and Martha, and you have Lazarus who looks exactly like Van Gogh. Like Van Gogh put his face on Lazarus.
Interesting.
And it was, and it's very Van Gogh-esque. It's like, it's surreal. It's not like, I don't know if that's the actual term, the art term to use for Van Gogh's artwork, but there's something powerful about it that I really, really appreciated. And people could critique it. Well, there's no Jesus in this scene. And where's everybody else? You know, you get all these historical questions people want to ask, but I feel like it's kind of missing the point. There's something that can be conveyed in the power of the scene by choosing to go in a direction that feels maybe murky to some people who think truth has to always be clear and truth always has to be realistic in art. And I think that you're making a great point that there's some truth that comes out in artistic depictions that are a little bit less straightforward and less realistic or realism in terms of its style. I appreciate that.
I wonder, as we get ready to go here, a question I think we probably asked you before when you're on the podcast, but you know, as we're recording right now, it's easy to kind of look at the world and feel like, wow, there's a lot of pain in the world and a lot of darkness. Spiritually, in terms of even like thinking about the goodness of humanity, whatever, there's just a lot.
There's a lot.
What gives you hope?
I want to say Jesus, but then I don't want to, you know, feel like I'm Christian radio cliche. The reason I say Jesus is because he is close to us in times when we feel hopeless. I remember, and I'm not sure if I shared this in the podcast the last time, but I remember when Lauren and I had the Syrian refugee come and live with us, and a lot of my hesitation and my resentment during that time was because when he came to live with us, I had to legally declare to the government of Malaysia that I was responsible for him as it pertained to his immigration status, and that if he overstayed or committed any kind of immigration fraud, I would be liable. And the punishment would be, the consequence would be imprisonment for me. That was a very real responsibility because we knew when he came, he wasn't going to go back to Syria. And so I was very upset. And I remember some friends, even some family, in their attempt to comfort me, encourage me, told me, you know, God is good. Like, just remember, God is good. And I said, it is precisely because I know God is good that I'm upset, because I know that he is good and he would put me through something like this and then he would be close to me in it. And the problem is not that he's good or not good. The problem is I don't want to walk through this. I don't want to go through this.
Right.
I don't want to be put in this situation where I feel so powerless. It's something I cannot control. Just one police raid and it might be over for me. Mm-hmm. But in that time in my, I always see it this way, like, you know, I throw a lot of tantrums internally at Jesus, kind of like a little child would. And I watched this video on, I think it was TikTok once, where this father was talking about how he deals with his child who has a tantrum. And basically what he does is just, he lies down to his son as his son is flipping out and he's not correcting his son in the moment. He's just present. And I see often that is how God interacts with me when I am resentful and upset and throwing my fists at heaven, perhaps even a curse word or two. You can bleep it. Beep. And in those moments, Jesus is near. In those moments, Jesus is close, right? And so what gives me hope really in this season, I didn't expect coming to Europe this trip. I mean, when I planned this trip, Russia had not invaded Ukraine yet. And being here and seeing, you know, with you, Jones, visiting sections of the Berlin Wall that have been put up as a way to remind people that this happened and let's not forget it happened, lest it happens again. Going to Bonhoeffer's, the church that he was at, seeing the memorial to Bonhoeffer and reading, remembering his story. I mean, this is a tough place to be. When you think about it, this is a really hard place to be. And all of this is less than 100 years old. It's not distant history. Mm-hmm. Like for me, the only way that I think would work to live here and be alive here and to thrive here is for an incarnational truth to be present, which is Christ is with me. Christ is here in the pain, in the brokenness. He is here. And that's what makes brokenness beautiful is Jesus. Yeah, so that's my hope.
Good. Other last thoughts?
I'm about to cry, but not really. I don't know. I think I've said a lot. Yeah.
I think just looking outside, watching the people walk by and ride their bikes by and yeah, thinking about the realities of goodness, the realities of pain, of suffering, thinking about what is truth, what's worth living for, what's, yeah, wisdom. How do we know what, yeah, what to choose? I don't know. I think one of the things that I definitely resonate with what you were just saying is staying present in pain, in the end, particularly in the pain of others, seems like something that I don't know how to do on my own, you know? And yeah, appreciate that.
It's been fun chatting with you guys. I gotta head out here.
Yeah, no worries. Thanks for being with us today.
Yeah, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
This concludes our series with Marcus Dipsilas. In our next episode, we get into the final series on Justin's dissertation, and I ask him what happened in the book of Ephesians. Thank you for joining us for today's episode of Professors in Rooms Getting Coffee. Reed Peters is a recognized patron of the show. As always, you can join us at patreon.com/profsinrooms for more conversation and bonus content. We hope you can join us for coffee again next time.